Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen. Gene DiNardo's off this week, and Jake Towne, my other co-host, is going to be joining us in just a few minutes. But here are some of the headlines we're going to be looking at today. Financial repression, back here to stay. Jake has an interesting little commentary about that, plus the new Federal Reserve sterilized QE proposal that Ben Bernanke's been running around the news airwaves, so to speak. Hamid Karzai over in Afghanistan urging the U.S. to pull back troops after the murder incident over there. The Syrian revolt is 1 year old. No progress showing up there. Ron Paul continuing to draw large crowds at his events. Meanwhile, over in Greece, things going from bad to worse despite the fact that the media has been reporting otherwise. The IMF reporting more money being given there. The Fed report on the bank stress test. We're going to go into that a little bit, too. That's going to be very interesting. But we're going to start this hour off with somewhat amusing, shall we say, a lighter side of the news. You'll recall last week we reported that Anonymous, that's the famous Internet hacker or cracker group that has been involved in some of the biggest computer vandalism scandals of the last year or two. They've gone after the credit card sites. They've gone after some of the banks and so forth, rather vindictive in their policies and so forth. And while they have achieved a certain degree of legendary stature, they are also a criminal organization. They had a bit of an embarrassment last week when it was released and acknowledged by the FBI that they had captured one of their top hackers last June, and he had been working as an informant for them. His hacker name was Sabu, his real name Hector Xavier Monsieur. He's a 28-year-old self-taught unemployed computer programmer with no college education who was living in welfare public housing in New York. Well, shortly after that, of course, now the entire Anonymous movement has obviously, they had some loss of forces because that led to arrests. I think at least five or six people were arrested as a result of the information Sabu provided to the FBI. Well, interesting thing happened this week. I work in the web industry. I get a lot of spam emails as a result because I have so many email accounts I'm managing for clients and so forth. Got an email that was sent from a hijacked email address at cbthomebank.com, and the email says, you got to hear this. Welcome. We are Anonymous. Think what the world will be like in the future depends only on you. You always have a choice. Either you continue tolerating or you join us, and we change the world on our own. While you stand still, nothing will change. Is it not enough to listen to tales which the government is telling you? Join Anonymous and change your future yourselves. And it goes on, and finishes up with a Gmail email address that you can write to. The last line saying, "We are Legion. We do not forget. We do not forgive. We are Anonymous." Well, if you ever wanted to join Anonymous, I suppose that's one way to do it. But of course, there is another risk involved. As my friend Jake, who's now joining us, Jake, welcome to the program. But as Jake pointed out in an email to me, that email could also have come from the government because, after all, they did find Sabu. They did bring him into custody. They did make him turn informant. Who's to say this is not part of a sting operation? Either way, I think it's fair to say, Jake, as with most spam emails, it's probably not a good idea to respond to this one.
It could be a sting operation for stupid people. or it could just be the regular spammers using some other type of method in order to get contact information and that sort of thing. So,
well, I guess if we go to one of the larger stories of the week, what we should be saying is that it's an email for Muppets. And the reason I say that, of course, is the bombshell op-ed that was published in the Wall Street Journal by an executive leading Goldman Sachs. This is a gentleman who worked in the upper end echelons of the Great Britain unit of Sachs, and he reported in his published op-ed that some of the top managers at Goldman Sachs referred to their customers as Muppets. Now, here in the U.S., Muppets, of course, are friendly little cartoon-type, children's show characters. But in Great Britain, the word Muppets means stupid people. So apparently, Jake, you just tapped into something here. Perhaps this anonymous email is for Muppets.
That's correct. Yeah, and the fellow who left Goldman Sachs wrote some pretty stinging words published in the New York Times and elsewhere. He was a major fellow there. He was a vice president in the executive director and head of the firm's U.S. equity derivatives business in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. So, pretty major fellow. I've been in the corporation for 12 years, and really just kind of highlighted. I think the main takeaway was he said that the firm's completely lost control of their culture over the last two CEOs and presidents, Lloyd Blankfein, who's the fellow that infamously and kind of jokingly said that Goldman Sachs is doing God's work, unquote, and Gary Cohn. So very interesting to see that, and there's been a lot of different it'll be interesting to see, number one, the replies from the actual clients to see if they stick with the company or not. And it'll also be interesting to see exactly what Greg Smith does, like if his if the point of this was to try and get like a speaking tour or to write a book, or if this is just the truth.
One of the interesting pieces that come along with this is this whole op-ed went viral globally to the point where the Wall Street Journal reported that the report that they did on his op-ed, not the op-ed itself, the report that they did generated 500,000 views in one day, and the op-ed itself generated over 3 million views in one day. So this has definitely caught the attention of a lot of people around the world.
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile, of course, other things continue to happen. I want to bring you up to date with what's happening over in Greece, first of all. Not too much attention to it being given by the major media, but just a day after the final nail was nailed into the plan for the second Greek bailout, the IMF announced that there is a further $35 billion for Greece that they're making available. And in fact, the Australian.com reported that the International Monetary Fund's board, not only were they expecting to meet overnight to set this new loan, it's a 28 billion euro loan, $35 billion, but that it was kept secret deliberately until the Eurozone nailed down the bailout program for the country. This, of course, feeds directly into what we talked about here on the Freedom News Hour for quite some time, that this crisis is far from over, and indeed another way that the crisis has become particularly severe and acute in Greece is another report, this coming from Reuters, that Greece's jobless rate rose over 20%. It rose to a fresh quarterly record of 20.7% in the last 3 months of 2011, reflecting the country's deep economic malaise. This is despite the fact that they were on their road to procuring this second $130 billion euro bailout, and of course, before anyone knew about the third $28 billion bailout from the IMF. So things continuing to spiral in Greece. Meanwhile, of course, here in the U.S., the question of whether or not there's going to be further bailouts, QEs from the Federal Reserve, is also getting some more attention. Jake, what are the details on that one?
Oh, yeah, the Fed just came out with a new approach, and it's just kind of a rumor published in the Wall Street Journal, where the Fed would print up new money, it would buy long-term mortgages or treasury bonds, but would effectively tie up that money by borrowing it back for short periods at low rates. So then what they would try to do is relieve the anxieties that money printing would fuel later inflation. And call it, kind of like sterilized QE. So to simplify this, they're just doing another market intervention, and they're trying to make it seem as if there's no net change, but obviously there will be, otherwise there's nothing, but there's something in it for them. And I think that the recent changes over the last month or so from the 10-year Treasury bond going from 1.8 to nearly 2.3% today, which is really a major shift for that major treasury market. I think that is just kind of a warning signal of maybe the Fed kind of saw this going on, because of course they are one of the main buyers of the treasuries. I think they're buying somewhere around between 40 to 60% for sure of the new treasuries that are coming out there. But what this scheme would do is that you're trying to just print up wads of money, buy up these bonds, and then suck in the same amount from the rest of the economy. from the banks and the reserve term deposits to make sure that, you know, no money. So what that does is no money will ever get to anybody, like a small business or individual or whatever. They're not going to see any loans, the exact opposite. They're going to suck out the money from the banking system, but they're going to throw in money to, you know, try and depress maybe the mortgage rates or the cost of the government, you know, printing up their debt. So, and again, the primary dealers, there's no way, and again, they're presenting this like there's no net thing, like, you know, oh, we're going to print up $100 and give it to the, or probably more like $100 billion or more, to the mortgages or treasury bonds, and we're going to take in $100 billion from the people. That just, you know, it almost sounds like what the Fed did that made the Great Depression even worse during the 1930s, which was really kind of put suck in more money from the masses, from the people, which is obviously not exactly the best thing to do. And the best thing to do, of course, is to not print any money in the first place and just let the market kind of sort all this out. But it's just intervention on top of intervention on top of intervention. And you know, I mean, it's amazing that you know, it seems like we've been talking about Greece forever, but you have to keep in mind that it's a very small part, you know, 3% or whatever of the EU. And a lot of the other countries over there, for instance, Portugal, I think the interest rates on their 10-year bonds is somewhere around 15%, and it's really kind of getting out of control. And from a column that was published on Bloomberg by the very, I would say, mainstream economist, Carmen Reinhart, it was an article called Financial Repression Has Come Back to Stay. And she writes in there that the European Central Bank, from May 2010 to March 2011 of last year, so it doesn't count the last 12 months, but they bought $101 billion U.S. dollars worth of the bonds of Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, which accounts to about 12% of the combined government debts of those three countries. They've obviously bought a lot more of that over the past year. And it's just another hint, you know, why is all this going on? It's going on because the governments don't want to lose complete control, but they're up to their eyeballs in debt. And they can't, you know, tax the private sector enough to pay for their welfare states in the United States for the warfare spending. And as a result, what the government does is they are going for, as Reinhart writes, trying to put in a period of negative interest rates, which is certainly the case, and to take away to really make sure that, like, if you invest in government bonds, you're going to be getting less than the rate of inflation. So you're literally going to have your purchasing power confiscated from you for the government. And also, if you're a saver, you're going to have the purchasing power of those dollars confiscated by the government adding to the money supply. And this kind of debasement over time is something that, in order to service the government debt and kind of keep these governments going, I think is certainly something that's going to be around here for quite some time. And just they use the term financial repression. What that kind of is if you have inflation at roughly 3% and just hold it there for 10 years, you're literally getting rid of the purchasing power of about 30%. Of the debt load that you have, and that's certainly what the United States government is trying to do.
Absolutely true. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then after the break, we're going to have a special guest joining us. Imad Ad-Din Ahmad is going to be joining us to talk about the latest controversy going on with the New York Police Department and its surveillance of Muslim students, so you want to stay tuned for that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. And we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown.
Imad ad-Din Ahmad is a spokesman for the National Coalition to Protect Solar Freedoms. He is also the president and founder of the Minaret of Freedom Institute in Washington, D.C., and he's here to talk with us today about a bit of a controversy that has popped up in the last few weeks or so. So, Dean, first of all, are you with us on the program?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome. Glad to hear your voice again. It's been a while since we've talked.
I'm glad to be here.
And just to fill in for people who may not be familiar with the report, can you just kind of touch on the highlights, if you will? What exactly happened? What was the controversy, and how did it come about in terms of coming to the public attention?
Okay. Well, it came to the public attention because of Associated Press reporters who actually have been given an investigative prize by Harvard University for their work in uncovering this scheme that was being done by the New York Police Department to cast an extremely broad net of spying on Muslims. Now, you have to be aware that these are not people for whom any kind of particular suspicion in terms of suspicious activity or suspicious connections or any of the kind of thing you normally associate with police work as triggering an investigation. These were people who were simply Muslims, and they were casting a net to spy on them to make a detailed demographic base of who they are, where they eat, what mosque they go to, what the subjects of the sermons are at the mosque, and so on and so forth. In fact, one of the triggers to reveal that something peculiar was going on was that some of the students who were being spied on were so suspicious of the agents doing the spying that they actually reported them to the FBI. But the layers upon layers of shocking or stunning revelations that have come about this include the fact that the CIA was involved in it, that the federal government was paying anti-drug money in order to pay for some of the costs of this project. And it's become very controversial because when I say it was a wide net, I don't just mean a wide net in terms of the fact that anyone who is a Muslim could be spied on, but you didn't even have to be inside of New York City, even though it was the New York City Police Department that was doing the spying. They were doing spying as far away as New Jersey and Connecticut. And, in fact, at Rutgers University, there was quite a stir about trying to take some action to protect the university from this intrusion by a police force that is from another state.
And of all the very serious allegations and inferences that are involved in this, that's probably one of the more disturbing ones from the point of view of a typical American who is not Muslim, and that is the New York Police Department basically went far beyond their domain. They went far out of their jurisdiction, and that simply isn't done in this country. I mean, all the other things that you described are things that have been done to one degree or another, but that's pretty much a new thing, isn't it?
Well, I've not heard of it before, so that doesn't mean it hasn't happened.
Or it hasn't reached the public ear anyway.
Yeah.
Very, very disturbing stuff. Now, what actions have been taken to combat the report, to combat the event and to basically fight back against the authorities who are engaged in these activities?
Well, so far, the only thing that's being done are petitions and calls for investigations and, in the case of some of the spied-on institutions, calls for the institutions to, to take action to protect themselves against this outside police force. So there are, but the perhaps the most... well, the thing is that my point and our point at the National Coalition for the Protection to Protect Civil Freedoms is that quite apart from how horrific this particular example of Big Brother is, it is only symptomatic of an erosion of civil freedoms that's beginning to take place on a whole scale level around us. For example, there's the National Defense Authorization Act, which President Obama signed on New Year's Eve. Now, there is a National Defense Authorization Act every year. It's authorizing spending for the national defense in the budget of the federal government. What makes this particular year very unusual is that within the act is an authorization for the president to be able to detain without charge, without trial, without review from outside the executive branch for an indefinite period of time anyone, including American citizens. In other words, it practically amounts to a repeal of the Bill of Rights.
And in fact, also, if I'm not mistaken, there is some allegation that perhaps the same act also includes wording that would authorize the president to authorize the assassination of an American citizen, although legislators have been storing back, saying, oh, no, it doesn't say that at all. But when you read the two key sections of the bill, it looks very much like it does say that.
Well, the problem is it doesn't have to explicitly say it, because what it does is that it sneaks it in through the back door as follows. The president, and when I say the president here, I'm referring to President Obama, although he's really just implementing and expanding claims about the presidency that were made earlier by Dick Cheney. President Obama has claimed that he has the right to assassinate American citizens abroad, whether or not they are in a battlefield. In other words, he's not just talking about, well, you're in a field of battle and there's an American citizen there who's fighting on the other side. He's talking about targeted assassinations of people against who are not actually in battle and against whom no kind of criminal charge of any sort has been made. And he actually, of course, did this when he assassinated Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen. Now, what happens is that this bill seems to say that if he has such a right, and of course I would challenge that he has such a right, but this bill seems to say if he has such a right, then it is not limited to outside the borders of the United States, and that he could assassinate an American citizen in the United States under similar circumstances to which al-Awlaki was assassinated, which is to say that there were no charges whatsoever against him.
Which basically opens up the possibility of a political solution being used any time that the administration gets some impact that it doesn't want one I really have.
Well, you are absolutely right, and I think that what ought to sober people up is the report that just came out today, a 500-page report about the hiding of exculpatory evidence in the case of Ted Stevens. Now, people may remember Ted Stevens was a U.S. senator, and he was accused of corruption. And I'm not bringing this up to say whether Ted Stevens is guilty or not guilty of the corruption. What I'm bringing it up for is to say about the procedure under which he was prosecuted, because the prosecutors had evidence that if it was brought forward and revealed to the defense attorneys, as required by normal American law, that evidence would have prevented his conviction. Indeed, this is so clear that the conviction was subsequently reversed. Now, unfortunately for Mr. Stevens, his political career was ruined, even though the conviction was nullified. But the fact is that the government refused to reveal evidence that it was not only required by law to reveal to the defense attorneys, but actually had signed a consent agreement to reveal. Now, what is interesting, if you'll think about it, if people in the government would resort to such tactics of withholding evidence that can acquit a man when they're dealing with a powerful U.S. senator, then what are they going to do against uncelebrated Americans who perhaps are even members of unpopular groups?
Well,
and if, under the current law, as it professes to do, you're no longer required to even make any charges, well, then how much easier is it going to be to get away with that kind of abuse of authority?
Oh, absolutely true. Let's bring Jake Town into this. Jake, there's obviously a lot of connections both between NADA and what the New York Police Department were doing. What do you think? Are we on the right track as to what the real issue is here?
Well, yeah, to comment on that, and you know, just to add to the part about this whole NDAA and the government assassinating people, like it takes us back to what we covered on the from the LA Times in December of last year, where the government was actually using predator drones on American citizens that, you know, weren't suspected of terrorism in this particular case. But I think it sets a very dangerous precedent to be using these types of spy tools on American citizens. And it's, you know, it's pretty much unconstitutional to do searches without a warrant. Now, in the case of the Predator drone, they had a warrant. But back to the whole NYPD, I was reading from the Associated Press article and quoting Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He said that, you know, this paraphrasing, but he's saying pretty much it had nothing to do about the Muslim religion. He said, quote, we don't stop to think about the religion, unquote. But when they actually took a look at the areas that were being done, like the Syrian population, all the Jewish people reported by the AP were excluded from it. And when they looked at the Egyptian community, the Coptic Christians from which New York has a sizable group were excluded from this new police surveillance. And they didn't really have any suspects. So my question for you, Dean, is, you know, is the community that was spied upon considering any type of, whether it's through the ACLU or any type of legal action against the NYPD for performing, you know, searches without a warrant and without probable cause?
Well, so far, I'm aware of several attempts to call for investigations on this matter, including a petition to Attorney General Holder asking him to conduct an investigation into the matter. I am not aware of any particular lawsuits on this particular question, because in order to get a lawsuit, you have to have standing. And while, of course, you and I might think, well, if this is targeting against all Muslims, then don't all Muslims have standing? Well, yeah, except that the New York Police Department continues to insist that it's not targeted at all Muslims, even though, as you have said, there is evidence on the surface otherwise. And that's why I think the first step is appropriately for to call for an investigation. However, I am aware of an individual who was spied upon, not by the New York Police Department, but he believes by the FBI, and actually there's some pretty good evidence to that effect, and he called up the National Coalition expressing his desire to find an attorney to sue the FBI for harassment because of their spying on him, and furthermore, it wasn't just spying, but apparently trying to recruit him for, you know, faux terrorist activities. This is something that has also been going on, and it's why all of these things are connected. In other words, we're not just talking about spying here. Once you talk about spying, you're always also talking about the possibility of entrapment. And here is a person who feels that he was being entrapped by the FBI was trying to entrap him. Fortunately, he says he wasn't interested in that kind of activity, but he just, you know, couldn't get rid of them, and so now he wants to sue. Well, he managed to reach us, and we were, in fact, we were in the process of writing a press release about his case, and no doubt, as we were interviewing him, I'm sure his phone was tapped, now he's been arrested. We don't know yet what the charges are. You know, we have some guesses. Our guesses have nothing to do with any terrorist activity, but this has happened before. When the government goes after someone for terrorism and they've got nothing, they will resort to anything in order to try to get someone off the streets.
So the obvious question becomes, is it the new NADA regulations under which the FBI have decided that they have authorization to arrest him? Basically,
well,
they
it wouldn't be, because the FBI doesn't do the arrest under NDAA. You'd actually be under military detention,
right,
which, of course,
right,
makes it even more horrific. So that's not what's going on here, but it's obviously, you know, the door is open to that. What's to stop them?
But if that's the case, then what is the authority that the FBI used for this particular arrest? Because if the FBI did arrest him, they have
to. Well, as I say, we're only
authority.
Guessing. We can only guess. I can tell you this much: the fellow put a picture of himself on the internet holding an air gun. and he once served time for drug abuse, and as a convicted felon, he's not allowed to own a firearm. And perhaps the FBI is interpreting an air gun to be a firearm. And but again, I'm only guessing here.
Sure.
We're waiting to hear what they're holding him for. I don't know. In the state of Pennsylvania, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know how long they have to announce what the charges are once they arrest somebody. I hope it's not too long.
I suppose we'll have to wait to find out.
But here it's clearly this is an attempt to prevent him from holding a press conference. It seems to me.
Right. When was he arrested? Is this
late? I think late last night. We were hoping to have a press conference here in Washington on Friday. I had actually drafted a press release announcing that, but we never got a chance to issue it because he was arrested.
Sounds like you need to revise that press release.
Well, we're working on it, but we have to find out what's going on, unfortunately, until they tell us what happened to him. We've lost contact. We can't even he's confiscated his wife's cell phone, so we can't even call her now.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though.
That's also the big problem, you know, with the loss of habeas corpus in our country, too, like that you can disappear and the government can just cut you off from everything, you know, in the name of terrorism or what have you. And the charges themselves aren't really substantiated.
That's the real problem with these kinds of draconian laws. Is if you are persecuted under the normal legal procedures in the United States, you have an opportunity to protest, to question it, perhaps to get some publicity and get some public attention. Whereas if they can simply take you off the streets without charge, you become kind of like a disappeared person, like in Argentina or a number of other, you know, countries where this can happen. And I'm afraid that we are getting awfully close to that happening here.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though. There is at least some semblance of freedom of the press still left in this country. I would think that the fact that a press conference was scheduled, it was ready to be held, and then all of a sudden he gets arrested and is incommunicado, I would think that in itself would be justification for a press conference.
Yes, but believe me, we're working on it. But the thing is that we're trying to get it. It's just a matter of time. In other words, they are going to have to. Again, I don't know what the law is in Pennsylvania, but in many states, you have 24 hours to make a charge once you arrest someone.
I think it's. So, I live in Pennsylvania. I think it's similar to that. I've not had any personal experience.
Right. So if they arrest, I don't know exactly what time they arrested him last night. Let's say it was midnight. Then by midnight tonight, if it is 24 hours, we should know what they're charging him with,
so
then we can proceed.
Waiting for the short term just to see what kind of response there is before you decide how you're going to proceed.
Well, we want to go ahead with facts. Quite frankly, it's a little awkward to talk about something when the facts are concealed from you. But this is exactly what is the problem with this kind of legislation and with this kind of activity, is that everything is being withheld from us. We don't know what's going on. We have to make sure that at all times the government has to be totally candid with the public about what it's doing. And while we understand that sometimes national security may require legitimate redaction of details, that's not what we're talking about here.
No, it's certainly not, and it's a very disturbing situation, to say the least. The thought that keeps coming to my mind over and over and over again, though, is when I look at the polls, when I look at public commentary, you know, I follow articles around the web as they get commented on and so forth, there is a tremendous level of fear, undoubtedly fomented by the political leaders, but there is a tremendous fear going on among the citizenry, and it is quite honestly directed at the Muslim population because that's what the fearmongers want it to be directed at. So it just makes me wonder. I would like to say that Americans would stand up and say, no, enough is enough on this kind of thing, but I'm not so sure. What's your reading on that?
Well, Americans do. The National Coalition to protect civil freedoms is a coalition of a couple of a dozen groups that includes, you know, some Muslim groups, but many non-Muslim groups as well. And in fact, just about any minority group, it doesn't matter what it is, has to share this concern, because the Muslims are only the obvious targets at the moment. It could be anybody next.
And that's really the key point, isn't it? It could be anybody next. There's no telling who the government's going to target. It's just a question of whether they've decided that X group should be the next scapegoat.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you mentioned, too, with this young man. Like, you know, for certain there are some terrorist attacks, although they seem kind of laughable, like, you know, the underwear bomber tried to light his pants on fire, and the Times Square bomber, who I think drove in from Connecticut and, like, locked his keys in the car or something like that. That was very silly. But there's many of the other times where the government trots out, this terrorist or whatever. They use their own agents to entrap them. And it just kind of highlights, too, that, you know, the if you get arrested for whatever, the cops can lie to you and get you to say whatever. And if you say it, you know, you can be charged with a crime, but the police, for saying possibly the exact same thing, can't be charged with anything. So it's kind of a double standard, and it kind of brings back, you know, the old saying, you know, there's freedom and liberty when the government fears the people, and there's tyranny when the people fear the government. And, you know, these types of, like you called it, Dean, draconian tactics, you know, this isn't the United States that of past generations. This is evolving into a police state.
Well, this young man that I'm talking about now, this isn't the first time something like this has happened. There was a case a little while ago the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California succeeded in getting a restraining order against an FBI informant named Craig Montiel because of the kind of, you know, harassment that we're talking about now. Subsequently, the ACLU filed a lawsuit on the mosque's behalf, and the judge granted sanctions against the government for lying to the court about its activities. And then, to top it off, now Montiel himself subsequently sued the FBI.
Wow.
In other words, the agent himself feels that he was misused.
It's good that he was misused. How that plays out.
Doing it. Jeez.
Furthermore, in the case of the man from Pennsylvania, what prompted him to want to bring this to the attention of or to take legal action was when he discovered who one of the agents harassing him was. The agent had, knowing that the young man was interested in importing some religious books to use in, a school that he runs, the agent said that he ran an import-export business and he could arrange the whole thing for him. And they exchanged phone numbers. When the agent didn't call him back, the fellow went online to try to find the import business that the agent alleged that he ran, and he couldn't find it online. So then he looked for the phone number, and he found out that the phone number was of an FBI agent who was already a controversial character for his involvement in another case. And when he saw the photograph of this other agent, he saw it was indeed the man that he had talked to, and that this agent was actually someone who had been charged with murder in Pakistan and convicted of fraud in the United States. And he became very frightened that such a dangerous character had been introduced into his life.
That's what
prompted him to go.
It's really something. I mean, just watching, not just on this particular front, which is a very serious front, the front of civil liberty, so to speak, but in every single area of our lives, including the financial crisis, the healthcare system. I mean, you can just name issue after issue after issue. The decline in moral standards of our political leaders is just appalling. And the way that our political and bureaucratic leaders are playing out that particular decline in morality in their policies and in their aggressiveness in terms of basically trampling on basic individual human rights is equally appalling. What do you think it's going to take to turn that tide around? Because this is becoming extraordinarily serious.
Well, you know, I hate to make this comparison because people, you know, always think it's an exaggeration. But I think there are lessons to be considered by looking at, you know, what happened where other groups have been made into boogeymen in order to justify enormous increases in state power. You know, when you look at Nazi Germany, I really think that without the anti-Semitic anti-Semitism, that the Germans would not have allowed what happened there to happen. And I think that the only reason the American public today, if you look at who's being hijacked, if you will, into tolerating these kinds of expansions of government authority, they seem to often be people whose political views, whether they're liberal or conservative, would be, in one way or another, suspicious of the growth of government power. And yet they have set that aside and said, well, there is this clear and present danger that we just have to sacrifice our liberties for the sake of security. And I trust your listeners all know what Benjamin Franklin said about that trade.
Yeah, that is a rather famous quotation, is it not? Well, Dean, thank you so much for joining us on the program. This has been very enlightening, and please keep us apprised of what happens with this young man in Pennsylvania, because this is definitely a developing story we want to know more about.
Well, absolutely. I will make sure God willing, we will have our press conference next week, and I will make sure to let you know about it, and you can perhaps have me or another representative of the coalition on the air to give all the details.
Speaking of which, why don't you give us a website and contact addresses of the two organizations that you're involved with?
Okay, well, the website for the Minaret of Freedom Institute is quite simple. It's minaret.org. Minaret is spelled M-I-N-A-R-E-T .org. And the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms, actually, it's got a couple of ways you can get to that site. The one I always use is ncpcf.org, but there's also civilfreedom.org.
All right. Imad Ad-Din Ahmad, thank you so much for joining us today here on the Freedom News Hour.
Thank you.
And we will be back after these messages. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. Run back. Turn up the dial. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And just a reminder, you can always find out who our upcoming guests are by visiting our website, www.freedomnewshour.com. You can also find archives of past shows there. And, of course, you can also find the archives at the network website, which is prn.fm. And as we talked about before the break, the Muslim population has been targeted by NYPD and the FBI in a very disturbing set of events. But it's not just here in the U.S. that things have been happening within the Muslim community. There's also stuff happening over in Syria, has been for a year. And Jake, give us the details on that.
Well, Syria, and also, I should add, has a minority Christian population as well. But today, the revolt that has turned into a very bloody uprising with over 7,500 Syrian citizens dead per the United Nations, at least, I should add, has reached its one-year anniversary. In Beirut, the Syrian state media reported that supporters of President Assad, so supporting the violence, well, in a way, streamed into the central squares across the nation to show solidarity for the government. At the same time, the dissidents against the government, so what we pretty much have here is similar to what happened Libya, there's a civil war going on, continued to fight back against the government crackdown. And, just as we were kind of talking, I guess, like a much later evolution of the types of things that we heard Dean talk about, a lot of the Syrian assaults on the people have been carried out by the police forces and military on unarmed civilians.
Absolutely true, and it becomes a very serious thing when you look at the particular film reports, which don't get shown on national TV very often, but if you go to YouTube or whatever, it's totally disturbing just how bloody the whole struggle has become over there.
Yeah, they're bombing cities.
Yeah,
their own
yeah.
cities. They're blowing up, and it's you know, again, it's always horrible when anyone dies, whether it's a member of the Syrian military or the people. But you know, for certain, Assad is the one instigating this most of this violence, I should say.
Well, fortunately, we haven't reached that level of violence here in the United States, although obviously we can't rule it out. But one thing that has happened is that the foreclosure rate is continuing to be a problem. It is now on the increase again. The Realty Track today released information about the latest in foreclosures. They are up compared to the last few months. They have they're still considered a 2% decrease from the previous months, but then again, the previous month was an 8% decrease. So the number of decreases is decreasing, so to speak. And analysts are basically saying yes, the foreclosure numbers are going to start increasing very, very, very shortly. And in fact, Brandon Moore, CEO of Realty Track, said February's numbers point to a gradually rising foreclosure tide as some of the barriers that have been holding back foreclosures were removed. He refers, of course, to the settlement with the U.S. state's attorneys. Although national foreclosure activity was pushed lower by decreases in a handful of larger states, 21 states posted annual increases in foreclosure activity, the most states with annual increases since November 2010. So things continue to worsen on the economic news front here in the United States, contrary to what perhaps the U.S. government would like us to believe is actually happening. On the lighter side, and this also falls into the category of danger and violent reaction, there's a rather amusing story about what happened with former Vice President Dick Cheney. He wanted to make a special trip, and it got canceled because of security concerns. And, Jake, where was he? Where was Vice President Cheney proposing to go?
Well, it's it is kind of funny, but in a sad way. Dick Cheney is now afraid to go into to Canada, saying that it's too dangerous for his health. He has canceled an April 24th appearance in the Metro Toronto Convention Center. However, the source is the LA Times. The LA Times article does go on to mention, and you know, again, Cheney has been to Iraq many times during the Bush presidency, but he has stated that one of the attacks that took place when he was in Vancouver in September of last year, he visited there as part of a book tour for his memoir, In My Time, which he wrote with his daughter, Elizabeth. Cheney was forced to hole up inside the building for hours as police and riot gear took on demonstrators outside the bookstore. And, you know, I think this is just a sign that, of course, a lot of Canadians view Cheney as himself a possible war criminal, and they blame him for human rights violations, including the controversial use of waterboarding, which is torture, to elicit information from suspects of terrorism. So there you have it. You know, if you're if you're at the top, eventually you kind of get scared. And it's kind of amazing because I remember after the Bush presidency, there was some municipalities that issued warrants for their arrest. And if either former President Bush or former Vice President Cheney, I think Rumsfeld was added to the list as well, stepped inside those municipalities, they would be arrested and charged.
Which is really quite stunning when you think about it. It shows just how severely the moral decline in this country has been, particularly among its political leaders. One other thing I wanted to bring to your attention that came to light this week, the Federal Reserve engaged in another round of what they call stress tests. And they reported that 15 of the 19 banks, the 19 largest banks that they were targeting, they said that they would be able to maintain capital levels above a regulatory minimum in an extremely adverse economic scenario. This was basically highlighted and shown to be an example of how strong the banking system has become since 2008. I suppose it depends on how you look at it. They said 15 of 19 banks would be able to sustain themselves. I say, well, wait a minute, what about the other four? I mean, it only took Lehman Brothers, which was basically an investment bank, to come down in order for the entire system to start falling apart at the seams. Now, granted, Lehman Brothers was a pretty big firm, but these are supposedly the biggest banks. So why should we feel safe that four of the banks failed
what is arguably a very easy test, because the Fed set it so that they could, you know, basically set standards that would be satisfactory to the banking system.
Right, and at this point, you can't really trust anything out of those stress tests, because what the government is just doing, and their recent idea, that they just came up with, that's been circulating that we talked about earlier, where they're going to buy mortgage or treasury debt and suck in money from the banks, and that's really actually to help the banks by. So they can keep some type of asset on their books in the event of such emergency. But, I mean, all these things, the American people are told so many things, and so many things rest on confidence. And when that confidence is finally lost, and who knows how or what that's going to occur, it's going to be pretty bad. I mean, most Americans think that their bank deposits are fully insured if the bank should somehow go under. But with all the, the combination of the investment banks, Citigroup or Bank of America, or even some of these local banks that have kind of gone out on a limb with the mortgage, with the housing boom, it's not safe. And if you take a look at a very close look, if you go to FDIC.gov and bring up their latest quarterly, you'll see that finally the FDIC Deposit Insurance Fund has pulled out of the negative zone. It used to be like negative $22 billion. Now, but it's still a very minuscule amount. Right now, 13 cents out of every $100 in a bank is covered by the FDIC's Deposit Insurance Fund. So it's just kind of a shell game, and it'll be interesting to see what happens next with, the treasuries, the interest rates on those shooting up, because that's what we've been talking about as a show, as being the next biggest bubble.
It will definitely be interesting to watch, and I still say it's just a shocking thing that with 4 out of the 19 banks failing the test, they're basically saying this is a sign of good economic times. I mean, I personally don't think that the market's going to buy that argument, but if the market does buy that argument, man, even the market's morality has gotten really, really bad, because it means they're basically arguing against their own best interests. Well, unfortunately, we're at the end of our hour here, but Jake, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Yep, I think Dean was a great guest, and we'll have to keep our ears out for what happened with that fellow.
We certainly are going to do that, and we'll invite you all to join us back here next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Stay free.